The hunt is on for a new head of the International Monetary Fund, even as the organization continues to try to manage both global economic troubles and a series of sovereign debt crises. On today's first backstory segment, we'll look at the history of the IMF, the most common criticisms of it, and its difficult tasks in today's economic climate. And we're joined by Simon Johnson, professor of entrepreneurship at MIT and former chief economist for the IMF. Welcome to our show.
Nice to be with you.
Didn't you work at the IMF just as the global financial crisis was getting underway?
Yes, I did. I was the chief economist. I was there twice, the second time as chief economist from March of 2007 through the end of August 2008.
So what was the mood inside the organization as the markets were starting to unravel? Was there any panic?
I don't think there was any panic, but there was certainly worry. There was certainly a great deal of concern starting from really April, May of 2007. And there were some serious attempts to press various authorities in the United States and in Europe to take this seriously and to recognize that they had a major problem brewing.
But had no one seen it coming before then?
There was limited awareness, both at the IMF and elsewhere, of the serious problems being built up in the financial sector. Prior to spring 2007, I think it's fair to say that most of the official sector across the industrialized world had bought into the idea that financial innovation meant reduction in risk, whereas in fact it was the opposite, as it turned out.
Didn't the IMF arise out of the Bretton Woods Agreement? What was its stated mission initially?
Yeah, the IMF was created by the intergovernmental agreement that was worked out of Bretton Woods in 1944 in New Hampshire, and the IMF's role as envisaged then, was to run the exchange rate system of the post-war world and to run it in a way that would discourage, well, hopefully prevent, but certainly discourage countries from doing competitive devaluations where one country tries to reduce the value of its currency relative to others to get some sort of boost on its exports, and then other countries follow suit, and you get the kind of downward spiral that you had in the 1930s.
And then its role expanded?
Well, the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates ended in 1971, and it was finally killed in 1973 by President Nixon when the U.S. abandoned its fixed peg for the U.S. dollar against gold. And from that time on, the IMF's traditional role, you know, literally disappeared. But there were many other problems and crises to be dealt with. And, you know, it's an interesting fact of life in the global economy that countries don't come together and create new organizations very often, and you couldn't create a new crisis-fighting global organization now, even if you wanted to. So the IMF has taken over many of these roles as the crisis have developed around the world.
Does it function globally in some similar ways to what national banks and our Fed do on a national level?
No. And you have to be careful with this. Sometimes people talk about it as an international central banker, but that's not correct. It doesn't create money in the same way that the Federal Reserve or the European Central Bank creates money. It's more of a cooperative. It's more of a credit cooperative among the world's countries. There are 187 members. Membership is by economic weight. So the bigger you are, the bigger your economy, the more shares you have. So the U.S. has always been the number one shareholder. We have 16.8% of the shares right now at the IMF. And it's a way in which countries are supposed to watch each other and countries are supposed to help each other. And the helping each other comes in various forms. Particularly, it comes as loans. And those loans, of course, have conditions. The conditions are supposed to protect the money of the cooperative, of the IMF and its members. But they're also supposed to get you back on track with a view to sustained growth with low inflation and so on.
How much money does the IMF have at its disposal?
That's always a complicated question. The bottom line is they could maximum lend out, perhaps at this moment, $750 billion if they really had to. They might be able to go up to $1 trillion. But the real creditworthiness of the IMF is much greater if you take the view that the major governments backing it, particularly those that issue so-called reserve currencies that are held by everyone around the world for all their rainy day funds, and that's the U.S. dollar, the euro, the British pound, the Swiss franc, and the Japanese yen. If all those countries are fully backing the IMF and willing to provide more resources in an emergency, then the IMF, you could reasonably believe, could access a lot more than $1 trillion.
Are most of the countries around the world members of the IMF?
Yes, almost all countries, with the exception of a few isolationist countries and a few that have trouble that are not member of other organizations like the UN for various reasons. But 187 members is about as universal as you can get.
So do countries have to be members if they want to participate in the global economy?
No, it's voluntary. But if you would like to be at the table and able to discuss the rules of the international economy and able to complain when you feel that other people are mistreating you, and if you'd like some protection vis-a-vis how other people treat their exchange rate relative to you, then it's a good idea to be a member of the IMF.
My guest is Simon Johnson, professor of entrepreneurship at MIT, former chief economist for the IMF. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How does the IMF typically make decisions?
Well, the IMF board, 24 members of the executive board representing those 187 countries, they try to make decisions by consensus. There are a number of very obvious repeated splits on that board, mostly between the richer countries and what's known as emerging markets and developing countries. The richer countries have about 55% of the votes. The emerging markets have 40 to 45% of the votes, depending on how you count it. And there's some countries that kind of can swing in between. So it can come down to, there can be shouting matches, there can be straight out exercise of voting power, but mostly they try and persuade other countries to come along with them. And you know, to be honest, sometimes the decision making there is not ideal because you're trying to persuade a lot of very different governments to share certain views.
So one of the criticisms is that it isn't always as democratic as we would like.
Well, it's certainly not democratic. It's never been intended to be democratic, and it never will be democratic. If you want democracy at the level of one vote per country, then you go to the United Nations. There's not one vote per person in the world in any structure I'm aware of. The IMF is weighted by economic importance and financial importance in the world. The justifiable criticism on that basis is that it doesn't reflect the current economic weight of the world. So the emerging markets correctly are politely, I would say, are demanding more representation at the IMF because they've grown so much and they've become so much bigger relative to the world economy. And the problem blocking that representation is not at all the United States. The United States would be happy to have them expand their share of the votes. It's the Europeans. The Europeans are clinging to a role that they had in the 1950s that is no longer appropriate given the way the world has changed.
The head of the IMF has always been a European. Is that because the head of the World Bank is always American?
Well, those two posts have been tied by convention in the way that you indicated, with an American heading the World Bank and a European heading the IMF. But it's not necessarily the case, and it's not one because of the other. It's much more that in the 1950s, when the conventions became established, the open international trading world was mostly comprised of the U.S. and Europe. Other countries were not independent, or they're in the communist bloc. And those conventions have held on a bit too long in the view of many people, including emerging markets and including me.
Dominique Strauss-Kahn is French, and the French finance minister, Christine Lagarde, has launched her bid to become the next managing director. So you're suggesting that you're not sure that she's the right person for the job, even if she would be competent in the job?
That's exactly right. She's the front runner. The European Union has about 30% of the votes. If they bring the U.S. and the Japanese with them, they'll have more than 50%, and I'm sure they'll be able to persuade other people. She's not only the front runner, she's also highly competent and an accomplished professional.
But do you believe it's time for a director from an emerging economy?
Yes. In general, it's long overdue to have a managing director of an emerging economy. But my primary concern right now is that Madame Lagarde has a big conflict of interest, that the French are up to their ears in the eurozone crisis, by which I mean they are responsible for the structures that have created a crisis of this scale. They have not proved able to deal with it themselves with their eurozone partners. They had to bring in the IMF. Now to have a French person take over the control of the IMF and get a position of enormous power and influence is a very bad idea for most of the membership, because the Europeans are only 30% of the shares. This is U.S. in part, U.S. taxpayer money and even gold. The IMF was founded on the basis of a lot of gold that the U.S. paid in. That can all be lost that there is nothing that says the IMF always and ever gets its money paid back. If they mess up badly in Europe, the U.S. taxpayer will suffer a loss. You should not want someone with a conflict of interest to become managing director.
In an article for the New York Times, you wrote that, I'm quoting, Ms. Lagarde will now travel around the world engaging in some old-fashioned horse trading, as her predecessors and no doubt leaders of other international organizations have done, seeking support and promising not to forget it. What kinds of horse trading are we talking about?
Any kind that you could imagine. There's a lot of favors that different kinds of governments want from each other. Could be aid, could be a certain position in a trade negotiation, could be a certain consideration at the IMF with regard to what the IMF criticism of your policies, for example, you want the IMF to back off. There are many things over which she would have discretion as managing director, and there are many ways in which the French government would be willing to help her get that position right now. So I'm sure there's a lot of interesting and complicated things on the table.
Well, you mentioned the debt crises in various Eurozone nations, but the IMF is also negotiating loans with Egypt and Tunisia. Why are they doing this so soon after the regime changes? These countries haven't even had post-revolution elections yet.
Well, that's a good question, and there are people who say you should wait until you have a clear and legitimate government before you have a negotiation. But on the other hand, these countries have serious economic problems, and they are exactly in the sorts of difficult straits that where they need help, and they're asking for help. They have governments that are asking for help, and they have governments that are members of the IMF. The IMF is bound by its rules to look at all these cases and to see on what basis they can help. Obviously, there are strategic interests on the part of the G7, on the part of the G20, so the both industrialized countries and the bigger emerging markets don't want bad things to happen in North Africa. So it's not clear that it's inappropriate, but without question, it is very tricky politically.
Well, we don't know what kind of economy the people of Egypt want, do we?
I certainly don't know, and I don't think they have yet made that determination. But the IMF assistance is not generally based on you telling them precisely what kind of economy you want to have. It's based on their expectation that you will use this money wisely, you'll stabilize your economy, you will hopefully prevent really bad things from happening to some of the poorer people in your society, and you'll be able to pay the loan back.
Well, what role did the IMF play in the Middle East before the Arab Spring uprisings? Didn't it push several structural readjustment programs in Egypt, for example, to make it less socialist after Nasser died? It was also worked with someone like Muammar Gaddafi, even though he has a terrible track record on human rights. Was human rights ever a consideration when the IMF was getting involved with a country?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know the specifics of what they did and didn't do in Libya. I would say, in general, human rights matter, and to the extent they matter to the international community, and to the extent they matter to the United States and to the other big shareholders, and obviously there are some inconsistencies across all these countries with regard to their policies. The IMF really is a conduit for international policy consensus dominated by the big economies of the world. They will help you if they want to help you, and they will find reasons and ways to help you if they want to help you. The IMF is a little bit of a tool and a way for them to operate at a step away from congressional oversight. No member of the IMF staff, for example, can ever be called to testify before Congress. And this can be very useful for American policy. It can also lead to some problematic decisions.
Well, the IMF has been accused of using crises to push market-oriented reforms, especially in Latin America and Asia. Do you think that's the case?
The IMF certainly makes loans under difficult circumstances for countries. And sometimes the countries in those circumstances, for example, in Latin America, for example, in Brazil in the early 2000s, sometimes the people in charge want to take the opportunity to change their economy and to remove some of the sources of power for existing monopolies, for powerful oligarchs, for whatever you want to call them. Mexico in the 1990s would be another case. Korea in 97-98, another very controversial program. Also, the reformers in Korea really wanted to push the chaebol, the big, powerful oligarchic structures, down in terms of their market power and in terms of their political power. And the IMF definitely facilitates that, and the IMF has definitely played a constructive role there. There are other countries and cases I'm sure we can find in which the IMF role has been less constructive, either because the bigger countries in the world were pushing in that direction, or perhaps because the IMF staff was taking a particular view. I am not in the business of defending the IMF always and everywhere, and sometimes I have to say more markets are helpful if they really undermine the power of the few dominant people, the people who produce a lot of oil, for example, the people who borrowed a lot of money, people have built up all the debt. This is a very standard pattern in emerging market crises and in the U.S. crisis, I would say.
Well, one of the IMF's prescriptions for Yemen was the reduction of fuel subsidies, but increased energy and commodity prices are the drivers of the rebellion there. So to some degree, they actually have they have forced Yemen to, not that that's a bad thing, but they forced Yemen to institute policies that have undermined the stability of the government.
Well, you're making a number of interesting points there. And as you said, how should we feel about the existing regime in Yemen feeling pressure to change how it operates?
In an article in 2009 for The Atlantic, you wrote, quote, "The challenges the United States faces are familiar territory to the people at the IMF. If you hid the name of the country and just showed them the numbers, there's no doubt what old IMF hands would say, nationalize troubled banks and break them up as necessary." That's obviously not what happened in this country.
No, on the contrary, the U.S. Didn't follow the kinds of advice that the IMF would have provided if they'd been called upon. That they weren't asked. They never asked to advise the United States for obvious reasons. And instead, the U.S. Government, including people like Mr. Summers and Mr. Geithner, who, when they'd been in different roles, when they had been offering advice to Asia, had told them to do exactly what the IMF was suggesting. When it came to the U.S., they were all those same people were in favor of big, unconditional bailouts, and keeping the same people in power, in economic power, and effectively with a lot of political power in the financial sector. From the perspective of an IMF traditionalist, that was a very big mistake.
Do you think that the IMF will just roll along smoothly now and weather this crisis with DSK?
Well, I think the crisis is nothing to do with Mr. Strauss-Kahn and his departure. The crisis is about the succession. And the crisis of legitimacy is whether the broad membership, including emerging markets, feel that the process that brings the next managing director in is legitimate, reflects the balance of economic power in the world, is consistent with promises previously made, for example, at the level of the G20, to open up the process and make it more transparent. There is a very real danger that by forcing their candidate through, the European Union is going to really undermine and delegitimize the IMF just at the moment when it's going to be called upon to provide a lot more funding and a lot more commitment, for example, of U.S. taxpayer money to the Eurozone. And that is going to be very awkward and difficult. And I don't know, the Europeans may end up destroying the effectiveness of the IMF.
Simon Johnson is a professor of entrepreneurship at MIT, a former chief economist for the IMF. And we have a link to his blog, The Baseline Scenario, on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.